Hello and welcome to Reclaiming My Theology, a podcast seeking to take our theology back from ideas and systems that oppress. I'm your host, Brandy Miller, and today I am joined by Camille Hernandez to talk about militarism and the military-industrial complex and the ways that it relates to purity culture. Now, I know this might sound obscure, but once you hear it, you can't really unhear it. Many of us grew up in Christian cultures that were dominated by militaristic themes that have impacted the ways that we approach our intimacy, our romance, our sex, and our sexuality. And so I ask that you just bear with us in this one. This conversation felt important to me in the broader conversations about purity culture because it exposes some of the ways that our churches normalize and our Christian communities normalize ways of thinking that we may not realize that we're submitting to until we hear how deeply they are entrenched in our language and our action. So this is an opportunity, as usual, to unlearn and to relearn together. If you like what you hear, you can always subscribe, rate, and review. You can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/reclaimingmytheology, or you can just tell a friend about the show. Everything goes a long way to helping us do what we do, and we so appreciate it. And with all of that, please enjoy this conversation with Camille Hernandez. All right, let's do this. Hi, Camille. Thank you so much for being on the show. This is going to be a bit of a doozy, so I'm just saying welcome in a tone that's light because I'm pretty sure to stay that way for about 45 seconds.
Yes. That's how it goes.
I am so grateful to have you here. I really am.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I love this podcast.
That's very, very generous of you. And, you know, today I had asked you a while back, not that long ago, I guess, I had asked you what you want to talk about. And the topic that you're bringing today goes beyond the level of intensity that I think a lot of people bring in and of themselves. And so before we get into militarism and purity culture, I would love for people to get to know you a little bit. And as you know from hearing the podcast, you know this is coming. I would love for you to let folks know, what does it mean to be you?
Well, first and foremost, my name is Camille. Hello, everyone. I'm a Black and Filipino author. I've been doing trauma-informed care work for almost a decade, but have been working with targeted populations for the last 15 years. And I feel really excited to say that I'm like in this program to become a trauma-informed education specialist. So that's really exciting. But what does it mean to be me? I feel like the word chaotic comes to mind. I have three really young kids. They are 2, 5, and 7.
Woof.
So I know, right? I got a lot of kids. I also work with kids who have high levels of experiencing trauma, neurodivergent, and have different forms of disability. So I'm around kids all the time, and I love it. But at the same time, it's pretty emotionally exhausting. But I'm also a poet, a writer. So I do write about things that I am experiencing or observing in the world. And I try to lean definitely into not just trauma-informed lens, but into the practices of collective liberation and healing and trying to see what that could look like for all of us in a way that dignifies the whole of humanity and disregards hierarchies of belonging.
And I hope that we can have that world. I hope that we can live in, and that I really appreciate your work in. And I love that you said all of that without saying kind of the big news of the last week of your life. So can you let the people know a little bit about what you've been doing with your time for the last probably over a year? That feels pretty relevant to what we're talking about today.
Yes, I did forget that, didn't I? It's so funny. So I'm an author and I wrote a book. It is now out in the world. It is called The Hero and the Whore, Reclaiming Stories of Healing and Liberation from Sexual Violence Survivors in the Bible. It's a very long title and I actually don't know if I got it word for word, but it's a long title. And it is a book that looks at 10 to 12 different characters in the Bible who are survivors of sexual violence and sexual exploitation to see what their pathway of healing and liberation could look like, while also integrating historical forms of the pursuit of healing and liberation from targeted people with targeted identities. So whether they are queer, whether they are people of color, impoverished, genocide survivors. I'm looking at all of their stories to see what has worked globally so that we can inform our own pursuit.
And the book is really good, y'all. I read a lot of books, particularly Christian or Christian adjacent books. this one hits. So just know that that is true. And as we start this conversation, it gets a lot to talk about. And so before we get into talking about militarism and the military-industrial complex and its intersections with purity culture, I would love if you could tell a little bit of your history with purity culture. How has that intersected with your life and your work?
My spiritual journey is, it's long, but it doesn't feel long. So I grew up in my childhood in a Filipino Catholic context. My mom's Filipino, so she raised us in the Catholic Church. And then around junior high, high school, sports was more important than church. And we're Filipino. If you're Filipino and you understand our obsession with basketball, then you would totally get it. I got injured in high school, and then during college, I had some friends invite me to their white evangelical church, and I was in that for about, I would say, 6 to 8 months. Then I went off to college, and in college, I was in the Black Missionary Baptist Church, and after college, I went back to the white evangelical church and was there for like 10 years. So every expression of religion that I was in, purity culture was a cornerstone of it, because I was a Black and Filipino girl who had developed very early on, reached puberty very early on, and had a lot of shame surrounding me for that. And so, when you hit puberty, your brain is developing in a completely different way. And I think that me hitting puberty so young and my desperation to be accepted really latched me on to the different forms of purity culture and the ways that it was teaching you to deny your body and deny yourself in like their very fancy different ways. I felt so othered and outside. And I remember my own family was like really confused because I had hit puberty so young. And so I had known since I was a child that there was something wrong with me in that capacity. And to hear that, like, hey, God loves you if you stay pure, was something that really, it provided me with a sense of clarity that that I thought that I needed at that time in my life, at the many times in my life. And so the context come in different ways, right? In the white evangelical context, it was, don't have sex, stay abstinent. And the abstinence, like I'm a millennial, so sex education programs that were funded by the government were abstinence only education programs. And so I listened to it. And in the Black Missionary Baptist Church I was going to, my older sisters in the church, their testimonies were very closely related to how they're like praying for a husband. Mm-hmm. And you know, we would have women come up to the front of the church and talk with the pastor's wife about how like they're praying for a husband and everything. And so I went from thinking like, oh, I need to stay abstinent to being like, well, I need to get married as soon as possible because that's what God wants of me. And I did marry the reverend son of that church. So we're like, we're like a mess. and we moved back down and we went to that white evangelical church and became youth leaders for, I would say like 5 to 7 years. And we're spreading the same messaging that we received. Mm-hmm. So at every stage, it was pretty much foundational to my sense of self, unfortunately.
And that makes so much sense to me, especially when in white evangelicalism and the Black Church, one of the major theological intersections is faith. I know that's like in a lot of, it's less in liturgical high church, is like the concept of faith as a ambiguous, amorphous thing that lives outside of you that can never be touched. It's just something that you find and like will in yourself. It's when everything is super ambiguous and you have like looming threats, even if no one's saying it, of hell or rejection or a lack of belonging. Purity culture served a lot of us in being something really, really clear that could measure. So much of spirituality is unmeasurable, and I think purity culture is incredibly measurable. And so for many of us, and I think I'm sharing some of my own story and yours, having the measurable of sexual purity, or even the kind of chaotic piece of if you're suddenly not quote unquote sexually pure, having a metric of repentance, forgiveness, confession, and that cycle that a lot of people go in gives you a connectedness to God because there's something clear that isn't just an ambiguous, abstracted faith concept.
Yeah. No, that's it. I was talking to a friend like in 2020, a few years ago, and he was saying that when the world feels unexplainable, people latch on to like conspiracy theories,
yes,
to help explain mm-hmm. what is happening in the world. And then they create like systems and equations out of those conspiracy theories. And I don't know yet if I'm equating purity culture to conspiracy theory. Like, ask me in a few months if I think about this more. But yeah, it makes sense. Like, especially in the Western mindset, we can't, we have to intellectualize it over feeling what is happening, because intellectualizing, we have been taught, mm-hmm. is what's safer than feeling. And I think about that in the context of like a lot of my deconstruction journey was like, was and is having mm-hmm. to find comfort in the mystery, whereas purity culture did not give us that
right
at all.
That's really funny to think about purity culture as a conspiracy theory, because I think about national and politics a lot, which will come into our conversation in a few minutes. But the idea that some influential organization is plotting a particular reality or waiting for an event or a phenomenon of some sort is so rooted in purity culture. And we'll talk about in militarism, where the church itself becomes an agent of the state to ensure national security through power and really masculinity. And so I don't think it's actually a far off thing to say that purity culture is a conspiracy theory, because it kind of checks all of the boxes of hierarchy, entity, ideology, cult following, uncritical thinking once you get to a certain barrier point. There's so many ways that it intersects. So I have thought about too, but not in a way that I've just never heard anyone else say before, even though it's been something that's lived a bit in my mind.
I like that we're both gelling, like we're both vibing with this. I'm down with it.
It's so unfortunate and sad.
Yeah.
So as we start this conversation, I want to give just some potential content warnings for rape, coercion, violence, war. I feel like those things are going to come up in capacity. So for listeners who are triggered or have sensitivities to those issues, please treat yourself with care and engage as you need to. Feel free to turn things off or 30 seconds at a time until you get past things that might be challenging to listen to. I want to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves, especially in a time where our well-being is so tenuous. It's pretty, pretty rough out here. And so when I asked you what topic you wanted to do around purity culture, you get straight to the military industrial complex and militarism. And so I am wondering, just to start, why talk about militarism in a conversation about purity culture?
Oh, it's intertwined 100%. And I just think we don't talk about it enough because what is great about the movement of people who are healing from purity culture is that they're coming back to their bodies and the somatics of it. Unfortunately, some people get stuck so much in it that it becomes like a very individualistic pursuit. And in order for us to like collectively heal from purity culture and really like just rebuke it in general, we have to be able to see systems and powers and structures and how they are benefiting from our own denial of ourselves. And that's why I think that's why I want to talk about it. But in doing other interviews for this book, I wrote two specific chapters on purity culture, and they both were intertwined with the military-industrial complex. And I've had a lot of people be like, that was really interesting. So I was like, oh, I didn't realize that no one else thinks about this.
So can you define for folks who don't know what military-industrial complex is? What is that?
Yeah, so the military-industrial complex, it describes the relationship between a country's military and then the defense industry within that country and how the defense industry supplies it. And then they work together as vested interests to influence public policy for that nation specifically. So the United States is 100% a military industrial complex country. Anytime there is a war happening, the United States makes bucket loads of money because this country is like the number one influential factor of climate change because of our military and all of the mm-hmm. testing that we do with weaponry, but also war builds up economies. And war has built up the American economy since, I would say, almost the inception of America. There is Asian American law professor who was out of UCI. She says, America is not at war. America is war. And that is, I mean, that sentence alone is framework shifting, because you have to, if you are a millennial, how many wars have we lived through? Right? Like how often do we see wars? And now we're aiding two very different sides, two very different wars. But we're also benefiting from it financially as a country.
Yes. And so where do you pull those intersections between that and purity culture?
Because I think some people would be like, at 30,000 feet, you're like, okay, tourism, all of that. But if you could even, maybe you could even start by drawing us one thread. Because I could think maybe draw a thread from abstinence-only education to the military-industrial complex.
Yeah. Well, abstinence-only education is not new. As a millennial, I thought that like we were the only ones to get abstinence-only education because I'm a millennial. I think I'm special. I'm also Leo. It's a very bad personality trait that I have. But Sarah Mosleiner's book, Virgin Nation, which I absolutely love, she is a historian of purity culture in the white evangelical world. So she has one very specific lens. But she explains in her book that every time America was threatened, or American democracy was threatened, specifically by communism, one of the strategies and tactics was to center the virginity of young women.
Yes.
And I believe young men, but it was like hyper-focused on young women. And so it was like, oh, the communist threat is coming. And then you'll see the emphasis and focus on young marriageable women and also keeping women to be virgins, and making sure that like heteronormativity was a key part of the country's protection and infrastructure every time that was emphasized. And the way that I like to think of it is that every empire has relied on the sacrifice of virgins in order to boost their military, right? You have the Aztecs, you have the Roman Empire, Egypt. Virgin sacrifice is like not new. And virgin sacrifice was a part of boosting an empire's military. In America, we have the same thing, except we don't kill our virgins normally. We do teach young women, men, and non-binary people and trans people to deny and suppress their bodies in order to ensure that the family unit, which is seen as the like key of the middle class structure, but the family unit stays stronger, because in the American mindset, when we have a strong family unit, then we will be able to have a stronger nation that is worth defending.
Yes, absolutely. And the tie becomes really clear when we start talking about masculinity and the ways that a masculine nation, or a nation that is centered on manhood, is a strong nation that is protected. You know, I think a lot of people were really surprised during the Trump campaign in 2015 that he was still able to win after saying that he was going to grab women, quote, by the pussy. Like, that there were ways that he could say that. And what that did, people thought that was going to ruin him for white evangelicals. But what it was, it made him seem like a strong and powerful leader because of the ways that the body, like, that being decisive or fierce in some way, even if violent and completely deplorable, we'll use the word, makes it seem like you're going to lead the nation in a strong way. And so I've been compelled recently, as I've been thinking about this concept, of how the church is primed for this rhetoric in every way, in how we think about battle. This complex doesn't exist without thinking about battle, and Christian churches don't make money without thinking about battle. They don't create disciples without thinking about battle, and they don't end up supporting our military in the way that they do and our overseas without talking about battle. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how we find militarism and the military-industrial complex in the Bible, or rather, not exactly how we find it, but what is used in the Bible to uphold this idea and perpetuate this idea in our public Christian life.
Yeah. What's your favorite children's ministry song? Just curious.
I don't know what my favorite one is, but I did have the song. It's not Lord's Army, though that one is like really in my head. I was thinking about this terrible youth group song where I think it's like Romans 16:19 and like just like sing the lyrics, which I think is like, be excellent in what is good, be innocent of evil, something, something, and God will crush the devil to your feet. And then you like jump, like, stomp the ground. Mm-hmm. And so that one, it just felt like, oh, everything is anti. Everything in that story was anti for me. So I'm curious what yours is and why you ask that.
Mine is Joshua Fought the Battle of Jericho.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I like tried to sing it in a sermon once and then I had to stop because I was like, I actually don't sing in public. I just want to let you know that like this is a very popular song that gets stuck in your head. But from childhood, we're primed because we remember stories much better than we remember facts, which is why I think it's interesting that people are like, oh, I love Paul. I'm like, you know what? You're a liar. But I mean this in the context of like the ways that our brain works is that we remember stories and we hold on to stories. And I think of in children's ministry, how often are we, because I did children's ministry for maybe 3 to 4 years. So many of the stories that we focused on were on battles. So David and Goliath, we had a very like with 2-year-olds, I remember this, we crumpled up pieces of foil and there was like a drawing of what was supposed to be Goliath that was a problematic drawing. So you can imagine what that looked like. And they would like throw pieces of foil at it because they were David, right? These 2-year-olds, or the story of Joshua, the story of conquest, all of the stories of conquest within the Bible are foundational folk tales to what has created Manifest Destiny and what has created the idea of empire. I once had a professor in college, and she once explained to me that all oppression goes back to feudalism, which I thought was so interesting because it's not easy for me to talk about economies in general. I'm like, oh man, my brain. But what she was explaining that is that all forms of oppression goes back to land and resource. In and of itself, that is feudalism. And so as I'm talking about children's ministry, I'm also thinking about the fact that what we teach in children's ministry really goes back to like a scarcity mindset with land and resource. And in order for us to gain land and resource, which is viewed as God's blessing, we have to push out harm or cause genocide in order to receive God's blessing. And then those are like the immediate things I think about, and how developmentally, especially for those who were raised in the church, like those are the foundations that your faith is built on these stories that tell you, hey, land and resource are so important that we have to create a us versus them mentality in order to receive God's blessing.
Yes. And all of that relies on a dual existential threat, which is because the United States of America is always at war. We see everybody else as an existential threat to our freedom or to our well-being, when in reality we are often, if not almost always, the aggressor in those situations, or have created instability across the world. And so there's the existential threat of someone's always trying to get America. Like you hear it in Donald Trump's language all the time. Like America is getting weak. We're becoming vulnerable from all of our borders. Like if I was president, this wouldn't happen because I'd be strong and manly and not feeble and all of those things. And so there's that existential threat that's combined with this existential threat in Christianity of hell, or even just like a nation being not a nation under God. And that the health of the church is directly tied to the health of the nation. And so if the nation is healthy because the churches are healthy, and churches are healthy because men are healthy, and the note of men being healthy is that men have families and wives, then purity culture is always going to be at the center of that, because purity culture is at the center of how we develop notions of masculinity in the church.
That's exactly it. Notions of masculinity, notions of heteronormativity, and all of it.
Well, and even as you talk about the economics of it, I think about even the quote-unquote economics of purity culture, which is that there is a transactional nature to purity culture that feels a lot like the transactional economics of war, which is that you deposit certain things, whether that is weapons, time, ideology, propaganda, and then you extract or you withdraw a certain type of life. And in purity culture, the thing that you are withdrawing is a happy Christian marriage with like a good Christian spouse. It is a sex life, it's a life of prosperity, it's all of those things. And can we talk a little bit more about purity culture and the ways that this plays out on the ground? Because as I've been thinking about the Bible and all of it, it's been very, very jarring. Because I think about even how sexual violence is used for nation building in the Bible, and how we normalize that. And my partner and I were just talking about how when you do like a Bible reading plan with people, the amount of stories, sexual violence and militaristic violence that you read are so high that we don't even notice them anymore, that we are kind of immune to having any kind of emotional reaction to them. But I think about Hagar, who is raped in order to build a nation, that Abraham is promised to become a nation. And in order to become a nation, he has to have people. And because people are what create space, and space is what needs to be defended by militaries. That becomes a story of Joshua later on, of trying to have a space for this Abraham nation to live. Or you have David, who is sexually exploiting in order to maintain a nation. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about some of those connecting points, because I want us to get all the way to the ground to how it affects people in real time. Because I mean, we could talk about Bible passage usage, we could talk about songs, we could talk about books, and I'd love to get there, but I think we do a little bit of a pass through of, where do you see people going in the Bible for this stuff, and what does that look like?
I think the story of Abraham and Sarah is a really good example of people going, like, just going there. How often do we talk about the faithfulness of Abraham in fulfilling God's promise and Sarah's desperation to fulfill God's promise to the point where mm-hmm. she others. And as scripture says, she becomes more violent to Hagar than Abraham was. But she does it in dedication to Abraham's, essentially his goal that was given to him by God. And that, so that power structure in and of itself is replicated. And in the world of trafficking, the term for it is a bottom bitch, that Sarah is Abraham's bottom bitch. And I know that like this language is really like, I don't know, some people have been like, wow, Camille, that's such risky language. It's actually not when you work with victims of trafficking. These are words that you need to know in order to be in community, to reduce harm, to pursue healing and liberation. Anyway, I say that because I use the term in the book. but yeah, this structure of power, that there is the male and then the female that works to achieve the male's goal, then creates a system of violence and oppression for the one who is targeted, which in this case is Hagar. There is a term that Bell Hooks uses in her book, and she calls it the patriarchal female, that there are women who are very much tied to patriarchy and will do anything they can to serve and submit to, and also pass on the gospel of patriarchy, which is not the same as the gospel of scripture. And in doing so, it is causing harm not only for themselves, which has happened to Sarah, but also causing harm to all of those who could have identified with her, but had to be othered because she needed to hit the goal of patriarchy. And we see that. We see that in churches. We see that in churches. We see that in culture. Like, one topic that I don't talk about ever is the trad wife, but I see a lot of people talk about like this thing that's happening culturally of women who say that they are feminists, but they believe in like mm-hmm. domesticity and blah, blah, right. blah. But really what they're doing is they're just oppressing themselves and exploiting themselves and exploiting their sexuality in favor of patriarchy mm-hmm. and like living their Sarai life, which they don't need to because there's no freedom in that, but they don't know it. It always comes back to, you have to be able to know what allegiances people hold and be aware of it, which is something that we don't think about in general when it comes to building relationships or joining community. But I don't say this as somebody who is like highly paranoid, although I might come off as that. But I say this as somebody who has seen how violence dynamics work. And you have to be able to recognize what you're pledging allegiance to and why, and the people that you're around and what they are pledging allegiance to and why. So that was all. And I say that on the interpersonal level, but let's talk about like government and structure, right? So when Obamacare came out, one of the reasons why it was even passed by and like certain Republicans approved of it was because they fought tooth and nail to ensure that abstinence only sexual education was at the forefront of health education in schools. And so we don't have like the abstinence only sex education that we had when I was in high school way back in the day, but it's still a part of our government because there are politicians who are continuously fighting for youth to have abstinence only education instead of having comprehensive sex care that would be safer and more protective for bodies and families. And that is impacting public policy. And it comes again, this ties to the military industrial complex in the sense of like, we need bodies in order to fight wars, unfortunately. And if a person is disembodied from themselves, then they are a better fit for recruitment. But if they are also raised in systems where hierarchy and patriarchy are at the center, be it male or female, non-binary or trans, then these people become better fodder for the fires of war. Mm.
Which is so bleak. And again, so the ways that Christian theology makes that possible are really, really upsetting to me. And we're just like I came from a family that had a lot of folks in the military where it's honorable to sacrifice mm-hmm. yourself for a cause, that you go into a battle knowing that you might not make it out, but if you tried and you honored the higher thing, then it's all worth it. And in so much of evangelical, particularly white evangelicals, actually, I think it's actually across the board in my experience of Black church as well, is that spirituality mm-hmm. itself is framed as a war, as a battle. and therefore violence normalized. And so when we start talking about purity culture and violence, rape culture, it's not hard to see the ways that aggression, violence, coercion, manipulation, really kind of tenets of abuse show up in particularly young men who were raised in purity culture, even they were told that they were trying to battle, you know, and maybe say it a little bit differently. It's like, in abstinence only occasion, the thing that you say you're battling and that Christian lawmakers say they're battling is AIDS or people, quote, having kids out of wedlock or teen pregnancy or things like that, which are all these kind of racialized ways of talking about sex and the outcomes of sex anyway. But the battle that you fight in the church is like war against your own body. It's a war against yourself. It's a war against your desires. It's a war against the devil who's trying to break down the church by targeting good men. And then you get like all these stories about David and all of that. And so do you have thoughts about that? What do you think about when I those things?
When I was in the Black Missionary Baptist Church, our pastor, who I very much like, I love him. He's a very important person in my life. And he was there when I needed him in the time that I needed him. We just disagree on some key things.
Yeah.
But he would always tell us, like, you're fighting against your carceral self, right? Not carceral, I'm sorry, carnal. I'm thinking carceral logic. You're always fighting against your carnal self, your desire, your human needs. Like, this is a part of being a Christian, is that you are at war with yourself. I mean, I bought it. But at the same time, I was like, also like a huge hoe in college. So there's like a part of me that was like, yeah, I'm fighting my carnal self. And at the other time, I was like, I'm going to go to the club. You know, so I don't know how much it stuck. But yeah, we are given these logics, which are carceral logics, right? They're logics that teach us that the best way to form ourselves is to form ourselves out of punishment instead of forming ourselves out of flourishing. Mm-hmm. Because if we are able to form ourselves out of punishment, then we make ourselves more moldable and malleable for whoever is coming in next, right? Yes. Because any development that we receive in one stage is the development that we're going to reciprocate and pursue in the next stage of our lives.
Yes. And for listeners who don't know what the book Every Man's Battle is, it's actually a pretty core text in the intersection of purity culture and militarism, because it's the prelude to books like Wild at Heart or other that we kind of engage with as millennials, at least. In Every Man's Battle, the idea, the central idea is that every man faces the battle of sexual sin, and the book tends to, through testimony and some like kind of funny praxis, to quote, free men from the shackles of sex temptation and sin. And the idea is that like men are attacked on every side by media and by their own bodies, and they need to be at war with everything and be hypervigilant of everything around them. This is where I get the idea of, if you've heard of the idea of bouncing, like someone bouncing their eyes, which is like that men are all like constantly lusting, like are just like 1 second away from just being lustfully out of control. And if you see something sexy or a person who's sexy, some sexy is actually probably a better descriptor, because some of the ways that that book describes women are, and I quote, hot looking babe, a tarantula, a goddess like blonde, her ample bosom, a point of glistening flesh, her
lithe figure, so horny,
blonde bombshell. Those passing babes, the prettiest one with the largest cup size, the curvy gym rat, one blossomed early to up top, a central serpentine, like wild stuff. And so his sense that women were a threat to his well-being had to do this thing around like bouncing eyes, so like control your eyes, your heart, and your mind. And again, I don't think all concepts at the most broad view are terrible in like learning how to be people who learn respect, responsibility, and consent, but those were not the concepts from the book. And I only say so much about this because it has been for a lot of people's development, and most of your pastors, if you have a male pastor, probably read this book at some point. And one quote from the book says this: our objective in the war against lust is to build three perimeters of defense into your life. So hear the militaristic language even as we can. With your eyes, in your mind, and in your heart. And so there's your battle plan. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. Setting up defense perimeters and choosing to sin. You'll have freedom from sexual impurity as soon as defense perimeters are in place. As the author states this, we must choose to be more than male. We must choose manhood. So there's this equating of manhood with a fighting for purity and like a violent approach to thinking about women specifically in this kind of heteronormative space that says if you don't have those defenses, you're done for. And what Wild at Heart does that I think is pretty nefarious without meaning to, because Edricks is like a soft dude, like not in like a bad way, like his not in like a like fraternal, no, like he's
like
compared to one of the other books, he approaches it softly. But his idea is that His idea is that every man is looking for adventure to live, a beauty to rescue, and a battle to fight. And his language is equating militarism, so those things, battle, damseling, all of that, with a fairy tale. And so the fairy tale that we're taught to want in purity culture is to be fought for, to be pursued, to have someone go through all of things, which is really like a hero's journey to get for me as a person who is socialized female. Like, it just, it feels like that's how you're socialized. And so the men are thought to be violent, domineering, fierce, and courageous are the words that are used, but really it's exploitative and entitled. And those come out of these core books. So even as you mentioned that book, I'm like, oh yeah, that's like in the zeitgeist, even if we don't use that book anymore, because it's wackadoodle. It's in the water that a lot of us drank, even if we didn't know it.
Yeah, it was in the water that we drank. I had my years of subscribing to what I now call craptivating, which is the women's version of Wild at Heart, where it came down to like every woman wants to fight in the battle and be pursued and like be known as beautiful. I remember the years that I was like, yeah, this is totally true, and then like looking back, I was like, this sucks. Like this is awful, because I don't want to be a damsel. I want to own my own fucking story, you know. but that's what we're taught. So like men receive what really is like this burden of being hyper masculine and hyper violent and protective, while also being very possessive. And then women were just like, we were socialized into being trained to be the thing that is possessed, protected, and receiving of violence. And so in my marriage, my husband wrote Wild at Heart and I wrote Captivating, and it was when we were engaged, I think. And now, you know, like we're hitting our 10-year anniversary and we look back on those days and we're like, man, we were like fighting some major demons, because those books were like so bad to us. But one thing my husband has told me that I hadn't like considered, because my lens, I'm not a man. And so my lens is very different from his.
Yes.
But one thing that he has told me is that no one should ever carry the burden that Christianity puts on men, because it's ruinous. Like we write these books that say, hey, do all these things, and that makes you right for God, without any coping mechanisms. And then the way that these men cope, in like, which is so awkward, and he's shown it to me, is that in these books, these men objectify women and make them seem lusty and sexy. And my husband was like, it's just really weird. Like he once read like a marriage book that was recommended to him. And the author was talking about like some sort of healthy marriage thing that wasn't very healthy, and then ended it with like, and hey, one day you might come home and your wife is dressed in a cheerleader outfit. And my husband was like reading that, and he looked, I remember specifically, he was reading that in the hallway. He stopped, looked up, and said, what the F? And I was like, what's going on? And he read that out to me, and he was like, I'm a grown-ass man. Why would I want to look at you in a cheerleading outfit? Like, you're a grown-ass woman. I don't think that that's something that we should be condoning or accepting. He's like, because I don't want to, like, first of all, you're never a cheerleader. And second of all, like, I equate cheerleaders with girls who are teens or in their early 20s. Like, he's like, I'm not a pedophile. But at the same time, like, you see these books, and I feel like their coping mechanisms and their suppressed sexual selves are implanted in the books, and we're just the receivers of it.
Yes. Well, and the irony of all of that, too, is in our political discourse right now around trying to have a strong nation is this obsession with rooting out pedophilia and grooming in liberalism, when in reality, so many of the grooming practices or so many of the seeds of pedophilia exist in Christian spaces because of that, because there is this sexual suppression that says that you just have to assume that everything and everybody, children included, are sexual. Like, it's when I see when I see Christians critiquing kids dressed in like pageant outfits or like who have like a belly showing outfit, and people are like, oh, why are you sexualizing your kid? And I'm like, that person is not sexualizing their child. You are, because you've been afraid to see everything as a fight that you have to win. And that means that even children are sexy and that men are lusting all the time. And it's completely, it's unhinged in so many 100% different ways. And you have that kind of nefarious end of it. And then you have, as you say, burden that men have, which, and the quote I heard a lot was like, become a hero to your wife. that you need to, in all of the ways that you exist, be a warrior for your wife, be a hero for your wife, fight for your wife, fight for your marriage. And I was like, damn, a lot of you are miserable because you just spend all of your time fighting for your marriage. Like, you fight for it, you do all kinds of things to make yourself stay in it. And that kind of fighting is just built into the books, the songs. I think about how many songs, like the battle is the Lord's, the how many times we sing in Hillsong or Bethel songs, like you fight my battle about God, and then assume that men are like God and their men need to be fighting battles on behalf of their families. The Mark Driscoll effect is really just that you need to build a family because it's a nation strong. It's all so interconnected.
It is. If you mentioned Mark Driscoll, and I think about how like so many of the leaders in that Mars Hill Church were like, they got married young, their wives were stay-at-home wives, they bought houses and invested in the economy, and they had these jobs and they were miserable and they were struggling, but this is what the Lord told them to do, and they had, but they didn't have a means of saying, this is not right, I don't need help. And the reason why I'm thinking of that is because like my husband and I, we are children of immigrants. We come from a low economic, like working poor class. And there had to come a moment in our own lives when we had to stop and realize like, hey, this battle language, this battle imagery doesn't help us out because we have to, like, we're struggling to survive financially, right? We have respectable jobs that don't pay well, because that's how the economy works, right? And my husband was like, I just feel like I have to be a warrior for us. He has said that before. And I've been like, no, you don't. Maybe we just need to move out of the fucking suburbs, right? I mean, maybe, and we need to stop owning this language that tells us that like, we have to fight to essentially like fight to be righteous, but righteous is synonymous with respectable because we are a marriage of two people of color. And so for us, we had realized how that language alone just seeps into how we understand what it means to like struggle in this economy that already exploits our labor, and how our own theology created an internal system of exploitation that told us we're not fighting hard enough because we're not receiving God's blessing again of land and resources. So yeah, it's just this ongoing cycle of really disgusting stuff.
And it's a frustrating cognitive dissonance because on the idea of like nation state and war, it's if you can stay pure or godly as a nation, then you have the justification to demonize, colonize, or wage war against anyone because they are inferior or part of the darkness or could benefit from the goodness of a pure nation. And that bleeds down into how I hear pastors talk about the church. And as you're talking about, even that like marriage obsession that exists in it. And there's so many stories that I feel like men go to, two of which you talk about in both of the chapters in the book that you're talking about. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about those stories, what those stories do. I'm specifically thinking about David, because David is like our primary guy that a lot of men go to excuse both their working and their fighting for something and their own sexual dysfunction when they quote unquote fall or give into temptation or make a mistake, which is really usually code for doing completely egregiously immoral or criminal. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the story of David, because I think there's ways that it's very hard for men to let go of David's supposed piety or his quote unquote man after God's own heartness. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about David and why you think it's so hard for men to let go of that piety in this conversation about purity culture and militarism.
Yeah. I just would like to start by saying, I think David's so raggedy. Like he's just,
for sure.
he's like a bad dude. But David is just so awful in so many ways. And I mean, one way I want to think about it is like, I don't write about it in my book specifically, but like David dancing before God and like, he was like exposing himself, right? Everyone saw his like kibbles and bits when he's like dancing before God. And yet we're like, it's so holy. It's so wonderful. And I'm like, there are children there. And they're seeing this man expose himself and dance before God. And yet we want to shame Mahal for for telling him to not do that. Like this man, like we joke around about like being delusional and how like being delusional creates success for us, specifically for like Black women, women of color. But David was like delusional in the way that like he didn't care about other people perceiving him. And in that in and of itself caused harm. And I'm not saying that people like not caring about how people perceive you is going to automatically make you toxic or harmful, but there, in my understanding of God, community and relationship and interconnection is actually a key part of our spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And yes. David is like this rugged individual, which I think is why Western men are so addicted to him, because yes. he was like, well, it's just about me and God. And if I dance naked and show off my penis to the world, that's fine. Cause that's holy. Right. It doesn't work out that way. It shouldn't work out that way. No. So that's like my immediate thought, but yeah, David is, he is this figure of military industrial complex within the Bible. And in my chapter, I, for those who have not read it, I equate the power dynamic and rape of Bathsheba to so many testimonies of rape that have happened within the Bible and historically and interpersonally. And what it comes down to is that rape is never about sex. Rape is always about power. And David is somebody who, if you take away the fluffy language from the Lord, and if you take away the Psalms, which is like another thing that I could talk about later, then what you have is a man who just wants power. And even when he is resting and relaxing, he sees Bathsheba and he decides that he wants to overpower her. And hence we have the rape of Bathsheba. I know people are like, oh, Bathsheba shouldn't have been bathing on the roof.
Boo.
Yeah, boo. Actually, she wasn't on the roof. She was on the ground. David is on the roof. He was looking down at her like a creeper, right? And when he sees her, he says, she's beautiful. I want to see her. But in that moment, he decides that he's going to overpower her. And then he rapes her. And Bathsheba has no one who would actually believe her and stand up with her, because the man who is seen as this figure from the Lord, as this all-powerful military leader, is the person who violated her. She had no political power to point her finger at him and say, hey, you violated me. And so she does the bravest thing she can do, which is to tell him that she's pregnant, to which David was like, abort the baby. And she can't do that. And so he plans to have one of his military leaders, well, he can't like unalive Bathsheba. And so, because Bathsheba comes from a military family, so she's a big deal. David decides to basically kill her husband in battle. And he is a general who is dedicated to his military, but that doesn't matter to David. It doesn't matter. And that's the thing about the military industrial complex.
Right.
It doesn't care about people. It cares about profit. It cares about power and winning. And so David does not care that a woman from a very powerful and influential military family has been violated by him. He doesn't care about her husband, who is a powerful and influential army leader within his own military. David wants him killed. And so Uriah dies, and David, who is still a power monger, takes Bathsheba as his wife, which is not, I'm not using this term in like the fluffy, happy way. I'm using this term in the sense that like Bathsheba is a prisoner in his palace. And she, not only is she a prisoner in his palace, at any given moment in time, David could take advantage of her body again, and she can't say no. So not only is she a prisoner, she's a prisoner of rape at any given point. So she's living in this hell and she's pregnant. And then she gives birth to the baby. David already knows the baby's going to die. So he's praying and praying and praying. And I think there's this like really interesting moment where the baby dies and David like picks himself up, dusts his hands off and is like, oh, that's it. And it's his priests who are like, shouldn't you be sad about this? And David's like, well, the Lord willed it. And then he goes and he comforts Bathsheba, which means he rapes her again. So at every stage, David doesn't care. He has no empathy. He does not care about people. All he cares about is power and the pursuit of power and making sure that his power is his power stays intact through the exploitation of Bathsheba, but also the silencing of those who question him. And what people don't realize is that Bathsheba is not the first person that David raped. He is a power monger at every stage of his story. And I think that there are so many people, I would say men and patriarchal women, who love David because they love that their pursuit of power can be justified through righteousness, which again is like a synonym. I can't remember what I was going to say, but they think that, that their wrongdoing allows them to be pious and righteous because, hey, David did it. Why can't we?
Yes. And we see that so pervasively among pastors who, I will say, actually, a Christian, really Christian phrase, I don't use very often, cheapen grace. Like, there's a way that people say that grace is so good and God is so forgiving, so loving, because in the same way that God forgave David because David was a man after God's own heart and so they were just, like, tight, God also will forgive you for all the ways that you messed up. And what I have found oftentimes is that there's this language of no one's beyond repentance and repentance matters more than harm done. That if you never need to acknowledge the harm that you did to another person's body, particularly sexually for men, if you repent. And Psalm 51 gets weaponized as David's repentance psalm and makes it so that he's good with God. Therefore, whatever we do, especially as like for men who are in Christian leadership, can be all responsibility can be abdicated from them because God did it for David. And if we know that we're loved and washed in blood, or if we know that we're saved by grace, we get the same kind of thing afforded to us that David does. What I'm like, David's story does not end well. Like, David's story does not end well. David's story doesn't start well, middle well, or end well. He has like one moment of courage and one moment of humility that we use to make the rest of his life not mean anything. And I see that in how we treat pastors who exploit and shame and guilt and perpetuate the marginalization of women and queer folks' bodies in the church, that they can say whatever they want because they're a charismatic leader, because they've built a church, because they didn't mean it, because they weren't trying to be, they just like wanted to give someone a hug. Because they are who they are, their power is what protects them, in the same way that a nation's military is accepted because it's the power that protects the tech that is rhetoricized to protect the vulnerable, namely women and children.
Yep, exactly it. And what is one of the best, the greatest strategies of war? Not great as in wonderful, but great as in most powerful. It is rape. Yeah, effective. Thank you. It is always rape. It is always sexual exploitation. It is always violence. You cannot, right. Like, there has never been a war where sexual violence did not happen. There has never been an occupation or a genocide or any sort of conquest in which rape and sexual violence was not a part of the tactic.
Yes.
And not strategically done to disempower a people.
I think that becomes really dark and troublesome when we think about marital rape in the church, because the justification for marital rape is entitlement, is that you waited so long for something, or like you were the most pious person in order to get the thing, therefore you deserve it all the time. And like, that's one of the things that actually, like, not to be in every man's battle too much, but one of the things that they took out in the 20th anniversary of the book is a James Dobson concept around the 72-hour rule. Do you know what that is?
I can guess, but please tell me.
Oh, it's terrible. Dobson suggests that men have a 3-day cycle of semen production, and if you're married, it's your wife's responsibility to relieve your husband once every 3 days in order to keep him from going to porn, to prostitutes, or to brain fog. Which turns out they weren't worried about brain fog when it came to COVID, but they really are when it comes to sex. And so essentially, if a man is not getting sex every 72 hours from his wife, you're making it impossible as a woman or a wife for him to keep his thoughts here. And so it's essentially that's junk terrible. Science that intersects with this militarism, that intersects with this entitlement, that plays out in sexual violence, sexual shame. And then, you know, and I think you talk about this in the book some, but it's way more, you can extrapolate it way more, where women are considered sexual objects and are at the whim of their husband's wants and needs. And so it's part of what makes the threat of queer folks and women who are not under the patriarchy so disappealing, so met with violence by patriarchal men, because it takes away one of the primary outlets for the thing that you thought you deserved your whole life. You've been told by the church is yours to get if you live a certain way. Mm-hmm. So chaotic.
It's so chaotic. And there's no other coping mechanisms that are taught. That is right. Like, sex is the superior. And don't get me wrong, like, masturbation and sex are coping mechanisms. But if sex is not consensual, then you're just causing trauma. And
right.
There is a very, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but Planned Parenthood has a very great, like, explanation of what consensual means. And I also write about that in my book. But yeah, it's just, it's terrible. It's terrible and terrifying because you don't, the entitlement does not come with any coping mechanism. Like I said before, reading these books, you're seeing that these authors, they're just instilling their own lack of coping mechanisms into the book and how they objectify mm-hmm. women. And my opinion and understanding of a coping mechanism is that it should give you the internal spaciousness to be able to have an empathetic mm-hmm. connection with other people locally as well as around the globe. And if what you're doing is not creating that internal spaciousness, mm-hmm. then you really got to think about who you're harming.
Absolutely.
At the end of it.
It's bleak out here, man. It's bleak.
These streets are so ghetto.
They are terrible. And one of, like, there's a quote that you said that as we toward a close felt compelling to me in some of the specific dynamics, which is that guilt ensures the safety and security and piety of a nation. Essentially, it's
yep.
And uh-huh. and when that happens, it creates a script of choosing piety as women and queer folks in order to keep your church, your family, your nation secure and safe. And so the responsibility for national security is not on men of control. It's on women and queer folks chosen pious in not being queer and in not being sexual. And so that by extension, power is given to boys mm-hmm. who are taught violent and predatory ideas and behaviors. And then they get the power to place judgment on women. The amount of times that I have heard Christian men say that they will only date virgins is wild to me without having that kind of sentimentality or that kind of sentiment for themselves. And it sets up the framework for a lot of the ways that men are taught to treat women and queer folks and to weaponize theology against sex in general, but against queer folks' existence and around women's ability to have agency over their own sexual lives.
Unfortunately, guilt and shame are perfect tools.
Mm. And if you are putting that in the framework of, because essentially what we're talking about in the military industrial complex and purity culture is that premarital sex and queerness leads to national decline. It leads to church decline and it leads to national decline.
100%. And that's, I mean, the pressure that people are facing from purity culture and that they're healing from is a lot of people mm-hmm. describe it as like, it's my personal burden. And I'm like, no, you have to realize that what has been placed on you was this understanding that if you do wrong, mm-hmm. everything in this country goes wrong. It is not your personal burden. And like I said before, empires yes. survive and thrive on the sacrifice of virgins. And so virgins are not being killed through purity cult, not often. But the way that we are sacrificing people's ability to be embodied to themselves and to own their agency and really be able to exercise the spiritual practice of consent.
Yes. Yes.
That is a sacrifice in and of itself. America is still an empire, and this is how America yes. sacrifices its virgins.
So if that's where we are, where do we go from here? Like, what are some tools or practices or things that we can dig into that would help us to reclaim our theology from militarism, military industrial complex? Because the impacts that I am hearing and that we're talking about seem terrible for everyone, even if they afford men, cis men specifically, power in our society. It seems like it's harming all of us. So what are some pathways forward? What do you think about?
I think that there are many pathways. Mm-hmm. It's like there's many paths to healing and there's many paths to justice. I have learned from abolitionists, and I talk about this a lot in my book, that like abolition gave me the lens for nuance. It gave me the ability to understand trauma, not mm-hmm. just as like a universal thing, but trauma is something that gets replicated in carceral logic. So my launching point was to become an abolitionist, to learn at the foot of other abolitionists, and then let abolition help reframe my own theology and how I understand the world. But there's different modalities of justice outside of abolition. There's healing justice. There's transformative justice. I just feel like I feel like justice work is always spiritual inherently. And so for me, I had to take a step back from the Bible, and I had to take a step back from like a lot of the Christian practices that I knew, and instead say, hey, I'm just going to be pursuing liberation. I'm going to believe that God is with me, and we'll see what happens. Like I said before, I'm like a really chaotic person. I'm like a crash and burn kind of personality. Like, I'll do my best. We'll see what happens. But yeah, I wish I could say like, hey, it's this, and then you can do this, and this is how it works out. But really, it is, in my opinion, once you understand, or once you allow yourself to dive deeper into the work of global liberation, because liberation is a global project, then that will inform and shape your theology. Because the unfortunate part of Western, specifically American Christianity, is that at every turn, at every stage, at every lesson, you are coerced into believing that militarism is the pursuit of God. So in my opinion, in order to decompress from that and really reclaim your own theology for yourself, you need to be able to rebuke, challenge, and unlearn militarism. But it's hard to do that if you're just looking at scripture.
It really is. Because again, we're so numb to the stories in scripture that are horrific in their violence that many of us are only able to do this work if we start to pay attention to the present violence that's happening around us, of which there are many examples. And the one, like, I would add a couple of things. And one of them is just that many of us are taught in battle language to never trust our gut that would want to be soft. That the parts of us that are soft or gentle or empathetic need to be keyed up into something more intense than they are. And I think you trust your softness, like in the ways that you want to reclaim tears or crying or emotional connection things in the world. That's not an unspiritual thing. I think that's a really godly thing to do. And so I think you can trust that. I also think that there's a way that we can hone our spidey senses around this stuff and ask questions. Like when we hear battle language, when we hear fight language, we can ask the question, why is this, or does this have to be battle? And what is this language, this rhetoric, this propaganda really doing to shape how I experience the word that's being given me? I think this is particularly true in preaching. Like if something is being framed as a fight, there's always a reason why. There's an ideology. Even if there's not a nefarious thing behind it, there still might be a harmful outcome. It's the intent versus impact question. It's like a lot of people are saying fight, fight, fight to eradicate sin and things because they believe that that's going to save their church, but it might have a harmful impact. I guess I have two other things. One is just that in purity culture and in militarism, women and queer folks become faceless, nameless, forgotten, and consistently shamed object lessons. And so if you hear a story without a name or a face, there's a good chance that it's propaganda or rhetoric. I think about that. I can't remember what his name was, but there was like a white pastor who told this story. It like was on Twitter everywhere where he talked about how this woman came on to him like at a restaurant and he said like whole long thing about how he's like so faithful to his wife. And everyone was like, that is a lie. And he had to come back the next 100%. Week and be like, maybe fluffed it up a little bit where you're like, that straight up didn't happen. Yes, he straight up like obviously lied. But it's this faceless, nameless threat out there that makes the purity culture conversation work, that makes him see, because so I guess he benefited from that story.
Lied.
He looks pissed, like he's fighting for his wife, like he's being super faithful. And I'm like, he's just lying about a fantasy he had. Like, that's a fantasy. He's living. Oh, yikes. And he's living, but he's living a fantasy. That fantasy is needs a pious narrative to undergird it so that he can feel good about himself. And so I think you hear faceless, nameless threats. You can see them in the Bible too. You can see it in Proverbs where it's like a face, nameless woman who's calling out from the corner. We can challenge those things. And in doing so, we connect ourselves to humanity in a different way. And I think it helps us to be more receptive to queer sexuality, to the sexuality of women, and to a sex positive educational future for our kids, which doesn't say that like kids are going to be out having sex all the time. It just says that they have tools to interact with their own bodies and the reality of the world that they live in. And so I think let your spidey senses, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want it to be, guide you into questions about the types of narratives that we've been given and why. Well, I so appreciate, I feel like we've just like scratched the surface of this conversation. There's so much Bible we could do. There's so many things we could talk about. But I want to honor your time. And so I would love if you could pitch, where can people find you on the internet and where can people find your book?
Yes. So on the internet. So on social media, my handle is Writer Camille, WriterCamille. And then I do a lot of writing on my Substack. So it's my first and last name .substack.com. So it's CamilleHernandez.substack.com. And those are the two main places to find me. There's other social media pages, but like, I'll be honest, I'm trying to stay true to my art form. I'm not trying to overcommit to content creation. I love y'all and I will create content. But that's like, at the end of the day, I'm a poet, I'm a writer and a theologian. Like, let me do that. Those are the places to find me. And if you go to my website, which is CamilleHernandez.com, you can actually go to my contact page, send me a message. I try to respond back with when I have spaciousness and capacity, but I am a fun person. I'm happy to reach out. I'm happy to follow up with people.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. Drop those things in the show notes so that people can find you. I so appreciate you showing up for my people in this way and for bringing perspective. I think a lot of us probably, as we've been listening, have probably heard a lot of our own story and some of the fences or frames that have been given that we would like to take down and replace with something more gentle and kind. And I think you've given us starting places for that. So I'm really grateful.
Oh, thank you. It's been so nice to be with you and your community. Thanks, Brandy.
Of course, anytime. Thank you for listening to another episode of Reclaiming My Theology. In the midst of these conversations that we continue to have, we do also want to hear your questions. So if you have questions, please send us a voice memo or an email at reclaimingmytheology@gmail.com. We'll take an opportunity soon to answer those questions on the show. We'll make sure that we are continuing to create a show that is helpful as we unlearn and relearn and redevelop our relationship with ourselves, with others, and with the Creator. And as usual, y'all, as we learn and unlearn, our hope is that we would do just a little bit better together. See you next time.